Under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wallop with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And
now what?
Well, today is Saturday, October 28th, where we are. And if it is Saturday, October 28th, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call and ask questions, make comments, or anything verbal that has to do with the stock market, investing, the economy, the meaning of life, the universe, and everything, or anything else of a significant nature, not counting team sports, about which we know absolutely nothing.
Yes, I hear that the Super Bowl for hockey is going on right now, something about the Dodgers playing in Houston. That is the extent of our knowledge.
The Dodgers, they dodge, is that like dodgeball?
I think it might be. Otherwise, why would you give that name? I'm not sure.
The Dodgers
sure.
are playing in Houston.
Or Houston is playing in Dodgers.
I don't know. Something's happening.
Yeah.
But we will say that this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and it is the name of a radio program, or otherwise we wouldn't be saying this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And it's also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the SEC. In Salado, Texas. And the two guys who are here, both of whom are bald, both of whom have beards, but one of them has a white beard and the other one has sort of a black beard. And you can call us white beard and black beard, or old baldy and young baldy, are the principal managing members of the firm in Salado, and also the two voices you will hear on this radio program. And that is not coincidental. The information that we give here is not investment advice, even though we are the principals of an investment advisory firm. It is educational. Investment advice is given to individuals, and so you should not go out and invest on anything that we say here. Stuff that we're telling you is we go and get it from normally reliable sources and reasonably reliable sources, but we don't make any guarantee that it's absolutely correct. And what else do I need to say? Anything else? I told him to call 254-773-1400 if you want, if today is the 28th where you are of October.
Yeah.
And you want to ask us anything about the economy or sports or things of that nature. Which leads me into the markets. I like it. The markets.
Yes, the supermarkets.
Mm.
They are super.
No, I don't know about
you
that.
Can get
anyway.
Eggs.
Well, the interesting thing is this week the Standard & Poor's 500 is up 0.23%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.45%. But both of them closed out the week at record highs. That in and of itself is certainly interesting. Gold has been slipping for the last year. It's down about 1.61% from where it was a year ago, and it's gradually slipping downhill. Interest rates have been gradually inching upward. As a result, had you invested in the premier, primer, whatever, one of the major bond indices, and you reinvested all your income and didn't actually take any of it, and you had zero transaction costs over the last year, over the last 12 months, your bond portfolio were risen by 0.23%. As opposed to the Standard Poor's 500, which in the last 52 weeks, 12 months, is up 21.38%. The Dow is up 29.03%. And the NASDAQ is also up 29.12%. By the way, the Dow is behaving oddly in that it's rising as fast. It has risen over the last year as fast as the NASDAQ. And that's all interesting until we look at something that I think is important. And we can talk about this if you like.
Not sure what it is yet, so I'm not sure if I like it.
During the last year, the stock market, if you measure it by the Dow, the S&P 500, or the NASDAQ, has risen, to use a technical term, a bunch.
A bunch. We're in the 20% range?
Yeah, upper 20s, like 29.
That's not normal, by the way. Don't expect this every year, folks. In fact...
But this is the thing that's not happened. No variance, no volatility, no... what we call beta, no jumping around in the market. It's been a very smooth rise. And frankly, that's got a lot of theorists and economists like us a little bit concerned because it appears to be violating economic theory.
Not completely, just that
I said it appears.
It appears, yeah. Well, we've got a caller on 773-1400.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh. They didn't want to talk to us.
Well, all they had to say wasn't really smart. It's bam, bam,
yeah.
Bam, bam.
Yeah. Well, that's at least as intelligent as what we're talking about.
And that's kind of weird because we have these theories that we work off of in economics, and they actually should be called hypotheses because we haven't had a chance to disprove them enough yet. One of the candidates for Federal Reserve Chair, Taylor. Has a formula by which he said interest rates should be set. He published a paper and got a great award for it and everything else.
Except it doesn't appear to be functional at the moment.
Well, he hasn't ever retracted it, and if he becomes a Federal Reserve Chair, theoretically he would immediately move to try to make interest rates 2% higher than they are, which most people would say at this point in the economic world would put us into a recession.
Yeah. Now – having said that, this I know we're about. You said you wanted to talk about this if you want to.
The absence of volatility in the market. We haven't had any big downturns in a long time.
Yeah, and that's again, it's not normal for this kind of growth, but it's also not horribly abnormal. This is one of those weird areas that if you look back to the histories of the market that everybody seems to remember, we remember the bumpiness because it happens. Then we have these semi-long periods of growth without bumpiness, which...
wealth without risk.
Right, and that bumps us into the, bumpiness doesn't exist anymore kind of category, and then we hit the bumps. We all, as a people, the United States and the world, are still extremely aware of the volatility that we had in the recession, where having a 1% movement, 1% to 2% movement in the stock market in any given day was considered normal. And sometimes we had 4% or 5% movement, and it was just, that's what's happening. And now we're having... kind of a steady, people are not really focused in on the market as much, so that gives it some more smoothness until people stop remembering that bumpiness exists, and then we're going to get some more. And that's all behavioral, which is when you say that the theory, the economists that have these theories, there's this two leading theories in economics at the moment, and they're led by best friends, which is their opposing viewpoints. It's Richard Thaler and Gene Fama. They're both at the University of Chicago. And Gene Fama says that the market is completely efficient, that there's no such thing as overvalued or undervalued. It just simply is, which if you think about it in a philosophical context, that would make sense. I mean, you only get what people are willing to pay for something, so therefore it is always priced correctly. Then there's the Thaler approach, and Richard Thaler came in from – both of them are Nobel Prize winners. Both they play golf together, and his perspective is that people make really bad decisions a lot in the marketplace, so that there are winners and losers. There are prices that are too low and too high, but the reason why they're too low and too high is because people are doing it without regard to the price in many cases. So quick example of that is when people hit retirement and they start taking a retirement income. Some people don't do this, but most people that are taking a retirement income from their portfolio don't really have a prioritization of what gets sold at what time. They just want an income. And so a lot of times they'll move their entire portfolio into bonds or something like that when that's really not a good idea right now. So the decisions that we make based on what we've experienced in the past, or not even based on market experience, if you want to buy a house, you don't, and you've been planning it for 10 years, and this is the date that you planned it for, and you want to liquidate, unless you plan it really well, it's really hard to say, well, don't do it now, the market's down. Because it's not about the market, it's about the house. And that's where the current theories are kind of flying out the window. People have a lot to make up for. The baby boom generation is pumping a lot of money into their retirement plans right now, which is most people don't even know what they're buying in their retirement plans. But that money is going into the market, which is causing a very smooth upward rise. They're trying to make up for their recession losses. And that's my take on why we're having the kind of smoothness to the upward rise. But it's because there's a lot of confidence behind it.
I don't know what's causing it. I know that it's there. I know that it has happened in the past a few times. And it's one of those things that my memory goes back too far.
To yesterday?
I'm more than that.
I can remember back to yesterday most of the time.
And very frankly, October, in behavioral economics, October is noted for being the month in which we have a lot of volatility, and B, almost inevitably, I mean, almost without exception in history, some kind of significant downturn in October.
Except and you can look at it and see about 40% of the time you get a big upturn in October.
But this is – the point is you get volatility. You get variance. And as we came into October, there was a lot of press about – a lot of press, a lot of media attention paid to the fact that exactly 30 years ago this October, we
on
had
the
market crash of 1987. So all of a sudden, everybody seems to remember that there was a market crash. People have asked me about it, just casually find out what I do for a living and say, oh, what do you think about the fact that it's 30 years since the market crash of 1987? I said, well, do you remember the market crash of 87? In many cases, they're my age. Oh, yeah, I remember. That was scary. I don't know. One of the things that there's a lot of hypotheses floating around as to why everything is so stable. Among other things, there are computer programs out there that are buying on the dips. In other words, every time the market drops a little bit, the computer programs jump in and buy stocks so you don't have a chance to get any what's called momentum, although it really isn't, on the downside. Which is a little scary because it's kind of like the portfolio insurance that triggered the crash in 1987. It's mm-hmm. like, hey.
Slightly more advanced, but it's still got problems.
We don't really understand what's going on there. We do, you know, in the individual program that's buying and selling stocks. And by the way, on a given day, I read this. I don't have any validation other than the fact that I read an article on it. On a given day, a majority of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange and in the NASDAQ is no human being has anything whatsoever to do with it. It's computers doing the buying and selling. And the thing is, we had these flash crashes, a couple of them, in the past, where somebody called Fat Thumbs, but where a couple of programs got into a cycle with each other, got into a fight with each other. If the market drops more than this, then sell. And somebody made a sale in a given stock, a big one, and it dropped the price enough that it started this program selling, and another program saw the selling going on, so it started selling, and we had these instant, few-second-long collapses in the whole stock market. Immediately, they sprang back. And supposedly, something has been put in the software of the New York Stock Exchange to prevent that from happening again. I guess it did, because it hasn't happened. I guess what I'm trying to say is things are going so well in the market that it's a little scary. But there's a reason things are going so well in the market. The bumpiness, I don't understand why it's not there. I can say that this economy is about as Goldilocks as any economy I've ever seen.
It's really in good shape. That, usually when we see the kind of confidence that we're seeing right now, we look for the weakness. So we're looking for the weakness. Where's the weakness? And we can see some weakness, but it's not in the corporate earnings area. It's not in the profitability of companies. It's not in the strength or reserves on hand at the banks. These are all in really good positions. We've got some big issues out there, but the core drivers of the economy are the moneymakers, the businesses, and the weaknesses out there are in the bond market.
Yeah,
and
the GDP just came out. I mean, the first, by the way, when you say GDP just came out, it's Bureau of Economic Analysis in the Commerce Department, and they make multiple, actually going over a three-year period, they continue to refine their estimates. This is the first estimate. But the good news in it's 3%. And in other words, during the third quarter of this year, which is normally a good quarter, we saw an acceleration or a growth in the economy equivalent, if you annualize it, out to 3%. The previous month was 3.1. This is the best 6 months we've had in a long time, actually going back to the time when we were coming out of the 2009 recession. And every number we look at from leading economic indicators, manufacturing, oil, exports, new home sales broke a record last month on the upside. Not that that's earth-shakingly significant. But
it is, though, because it says something about where we are.
Well, when it says broke a record, I kind of like the idea that it was the highest since, what, 19 some time, a long time ago. I don't remember exactly how long ago, but it was a long time ago. 667,000 sales, the highest level in 25 years. Hey, we had a lot fewer houses 25 years ago. We need to be breaking records.
Right.
But new home sales rose 18.7% in September. Now, why is that significant? I mean, 1 month, 18.7%, it could be a little flake. That was the month when we had the big hurricanes. And this is the interesting thing. You'd say, okay, well, all the sales were up in the Northeast or California or someplace. Well, no, they had fires, so it wouldn't have been in California. It was in the South. It was actually in the areas like Texas, most affected by the hurricane. We had the highest new home sales that we've had in 25 years, which is pretty amazing. And a lot of things are happening in the economy that don't seem to make a lot of sense.
Housing starts were down a little bit this last month, but that had more to do with lack of available people to build the house than demand. Because if we look at mortgage interest, interest in new mortgages, and there's a place you can go to look at some of this stuff that's kind of fascinating. I really enjoy this. There's a Google does a real estate index. They do an index on a bunch of stuff. They've got bankruptcy and commercial lending. They've got air travel and rental and luxury goods. And if you Google real estate index, What you can do is you can look at the, since Google's been keeping records on search results, you can look at people's searches, how many people are searching for what things, what areas, over time, and you can see, for instance, when's a good time to sell your house? If you look at year by year, are
when
you
you're ready to move.
When you're ready to move, that may be a good consideration. You want to leave in the middle of October, you put your house on the market. The problem is that every year since 2004, we get about, well, less than half of the demand for buying houses through November and December. Because who wants to move in the middle of Thanksgiving or Christmas? And you can see the little valleys on this thing. So we're the nerds of the nerds. We're the geekiest of geeks. And I spend my quality time looking at statistics. Google's just provided a whole bunch of good statistics. And when I look at people being interested in buying houses right now, we're at the highest level based on Google searches this year that we've got on record, which goes all the way back through 2004. That says something. We had half, less than half of the demand that we're seeing now back in 2010. 2010 was a year that people were really feeling the drop in real estate prices. They were not looking to buy, which is backwards. You know, you would think people would be looking to buy when the prices are down.
Oh, no, no.
That's
no,
not
sell.
The way it works. You that's sell, when you sell.
You sell when prices are down and you buy when prices are high.
Right. And that seems to be the habit that the people of the world have altogether is that, oh, things are in bad shape. Let's get out of it. If you are planning on selling a house and it's not crucial to sell immediately, then take a look at these trends. Look at when people are interested in buying houses, and you'll find that you're much more likely to sell your house quickly if you do it based on a pretty normal recurring pattern. There is a massive spike upwards from after Christmas. As soon as January hits, it's like everybody's New Year's resolution that is, I'm going to buy a house. You see this massive spike. And if you look at home buying and new housing starts, what you find is that in February, which is after the funding has been acquired, you see this big jump up in housing prices and new housing starts, not prices. So then we peak out almost every year right at the end of summer, because if you've got kids and you're moving, that's when you want to move. So this is another behavioral thing that people, you know, the common thought is, I need to sell my house, so I'm going to get out of it, and I want to go buy that house over there. Usually that coincides with you buying the house at the perfect time for people to sell it. You bought it sometime in summer, and now you're trying to sell your house sometime in November or December. And it's a pattern that we can look at and recognize. And until everybody recognizes the pattern, it's still going to be there. If everybody says, oh, it's a bad time to sell your house in the middle of summer, or a bad time to buy a house in the middle of summer, that's not going to happen, by the way. People aren't going to make that decision. There's too many other things going on. People don't buy their house based on when it's the best time to buy. Like they don't sell when it's the best time to sell.
People who want to rent the house out, which, by the way, generally doesn't work profitably, unless you buy at the low end, do have the opportunity to choose when to buy. It's an interesting, to say the least, economy that we're in. And I think one of the big things that's going on is we are transitioning, and this is just a call on my part. I think we're making the turn from looking back to the crisis that we just came out of, to looking forward with optimism to the future. Now, do I personally share an unbridled optimism about the future? No, but that's my job.
It's our job to be pessimistic about certain things.
But I think, well, the Consumer Confidence Survey, University of Michigan, came out 101.7, I think it is.
That's really high.
But very recently it was 95. It's up 15% over the last year, their index. And when people said, why are you so optimistic about the future? They say, hey, we got good jobs with good wages, and they finally are concluding there's not any inflation out there, which is an interesting transition in people's minds. They previously were saying, oh, we expect high inflation in the near future. Now they're not expecting high inflation in the near future. And there's a consensus that the good times will probably continue for at least another 5 years.
This is important to recognize in the middle of this, because you've used the statistic, the consumer's confidence statistic. And it's funny because the confidence numbers, that the numbers are being asked, the questions are being asked based on what do you expect to happen in the future. But we consider the consumer confidence index a lagging indicator, because most people's view of the future is what they've experienced recently in the past. So during the recovery from the recession, when things were markedly better, when all forms of measurement were great, consumer confidence was still in the pits, because our confidence is based on a length of time that we've had the ability to gain that confidence. It's a lagging indicator. The leading indicators are also looking good, though, which means that's another thing pointing at why we're having the small amount of volatility in the market. We've had a period long enough where we can build the confidence, and we're still building back the demand that wasn't met. The people that wanted to buy houses during the recession and they said, no, we're going to wait, we can't afford this. And there's numbers that you can look at for that too. The household formation rate, that's the rate at which new households are forming, kids moving out of their parents' house after college or not having attended college. A lot of people were staying with their parents even after they got married, even after they had kids. And this was a thing that it's pretty unusual, unless you look back at the 1970s or you look back in the 1930s. So coming out of these big changes, what demand is coming back, and this is one of those areas that if
demand is coming back,
not only coming back, it's now higher than it was prior to the recession.
It's good news that the demand is coming back.
Yes, demand.
Yes, demand. I know him. So we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. It's Chris in Texas.
Chris, wow. Wait a minute. You used to be from Georgetown.
I still live in Georgetown.
Oh, okay.
But that is Texas.
Yeah, I know that is Texas.
But he's broadening his mind.
But he changed his name. I mean, Chris von Georgetown.
What that means is he's getting more important.
I guess Chris von Tejas.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting important, all right, in my own mind. That's for sure.
And on the radio.
Yeah, we're a legend in our own minds, too.
Yeah. You guys got to stop the sports analogies. They're really bad. They're really, really bad.
Which sports?
We had sports analogies?
Yeah, the Dodgers. That's pretty bad.
I guess they would play dodgeball if they would be Dodgers. Why would they be Dodgers if they're playing some other game? What are they dodging?
The ball, a 90-mile-an-hour ball.
Well, why would they want it?
Why don't they smack it? Why can't they be the smackers or the hitters? Or
the sluggers or something like that.
But they
Dodgers?
Were the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah, but what were they dodging in Brooklyn?
See, this is part of the problem with us nerds, that we're like the Brooklyn Dodgers, but they're not in Brooklyn anymore.
I don't like that. That's like the Houston Oilers not taking. I mean, they're still the Texans. They're like I don't get that either. Like the Lakers, the LA Lakers used to be in Minnesota. Okay, that makes sense.
There's some really good studies on this, by the way.
I don't think there are any lakes in LA.
There's a really good study, a series of studies on this that people really. And when it comes down to it, to break down the study to its simplest outcome, people really are only cheering for a uniform that has the name of their town on it, or a town that they like, or a uniform color that they like, because their favorite player, when traded to another team, suddenly becomes their least favorite player. So it's not really about the team.
I haven't figured this out.
It's not really about the players. It's really about the uniform.
Oh, yeah. There's hated people. I mean, Lyle Alzada went from Denver to the Raiders, and he is like a vile.
Is the Raiders a town like Denver?
I think they're playing the Dodgers next week.
Well, Oakland Raiders. That makes sense.
Oakland. Okay, so he moved from the tribe of Denver to the tribe of Oakland.
Yeah, he went from one criminal. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Whatever.
I'll stop there.
But that's not why you called.
No, I was asking you. So the thing with the whole scandal right now, the uranium and stuff, and the bank that was handling payments. How do you when something like that happens, law based? How do you get records from a bank? Who does that? Like, if you're gonna say, okay, I need to see your bank records because we think there's criminal.
You have to get a court order.
Well, yeah, the prosecutor can go to the bank regulators. A lot of times, that's the Federal Reserve.
Go to a judge and say, look, I've got reason to believe I have reasonable expectation that criminal activity occurred. Therefore, I want a subpoena for the records in these specific records.
Right. And so a court would issue a warrant or a subpoena directly to the bank saying issue data on all transactions here. And then you can follow that to if it came from another bank, then you would immediately turn to that bank and subpoena them as well and follow the trail all the way back. And there are quicker ways of doing that now so that you can get a subpoena having to deal with transactions on somebody's account and the transaction chain going back rather than getting a subpoena for each institution. You just go and say, hey, this occurred.
You said the uranium thing. You mean, would you define that a little further?
Well, the trading of the uranium in the United States where the Russians are trying to get a hold of it, so they're selling the rights to the Russian company.
There was a company in Canada that had an interest in a uranium mine in the United States, which is perfectly normal.
Right.
And a Russian company bought into the Canadian company.
Right.
But if I recall correctly, the interest was only 25%. Does that match with your recollection?
It sounds right, yeah.
Which means they didn't have financial control or the ability to tell the company what to do. They just bought – it was an investment by a Russian company and a Canadian company, and the Canadian company happened to own 25% of the shares of a mine company in the United States. Personally, I don't think it's any big thing. If they don't have a majority ownership, they're just giving them money. Maybe I missed something there. I'm not sure what it would be that I missed, but I think that's one of those things where I think a mountain is being made out of a molehill here.
Yeah,
so if Russia has ownership in that company, and if the stories are correct, that the uranium was shipped into Canada without the proper authorization from the proper people in the United States, because uranium obviously is something you don't want in anybody's hands.
If it's uranium ore, the raw ore, I don't know that there's big restrictions on where you can ship it.
You can eBay that. You can get on eBay and buy uranium ore. The refining process is a little hard.
Well, my assumption is yellow cake, which is for nuclear use.
Right.
That's what I understand was taken out of the United States, it's already processed and shipped to Canada,
right.
And then they don't know where it went from there. This is, again, I'm just following the story.
Well, that is pretty.
You can follow the story.
Yeah, that's.
And it may not be true.
Yeah, that's the point. I've seen very little validation on that particular story. I think it could, obviously, it could be something serious. It also could be an absolute nothing. Yellow cake by itself, you could have it in your house and it wouldn't actually be a significant issue. It has to be refined a lot further than that. So the initial refining step when you take the ore down to yellow cake. And it could be that, yeah, it was shipped to – but here's the point. Russia has an abundance of uranium in Russia.
Right.
So it's not like, hey, some uranium – ore was mined in the United States, refined into yellow cake, and the Russians are getting it because they don't have any. Now, right. What has happened here is that there was a Russian executive, and the company involved was Rostrum, or Rosatom. There it is, Rosatom. There was a Russian involved there that was clearly laundering money. The source of the money to buy parts of something were missing. So he got a 48-month prison sentence.
Right.
What's fascinating about this is if you read about what happens in Russia, most financial transactions are corrupt in Russia. And it's not even it to them. They don't even consider it corruption. It's just, yes, you get money from places. It's just the way you do business. You've always done business that way. The Soviets didn't track it well. The new government, if you can call it new, doesn't track it well, except that when it does find it and it hits the news big enough, they can cause some oligarch somewhere to go to prison. Well, in this case, exactly the same thing happened. They were getting money from Russian oligarchs, or maybe the Russian government. We don't know. There was definitely some laundering going on of that money. Where did it come from? And when we can get bank records in the United States and from most of the rest of the world, it doesn't apply in Russia. We can't go to a Russian bank and say a U.S. court is subpoenaing your data, because they will stick a half a peace sign back to us. It's not the pleasant half.
Well, it could be that I don't know where all the – I've kind of followed this around, and it comes from many places. WikiLeaks released a document showing that Robert Mueller – is this the one you're talking about?
Well, I think that not the invest. I don't know where his investigation is going. You know,
I'm talking about that he was he participated in selling in getting a sample of highly enriched uranium, just a tiny sample.
Don't know about that.
To the Russians, apparently, okay, that's not the one you're talking about. That's a big deal that's floating around. In fact, what was happening is the FBI asked him to do that.
That would probably, if it's all true and said in this investigation, this undercover investigation of this businessman finding out all these, you know, corrupt things going on, you know, I'm sure the FBI is involved some form or some fashion, something. I mean, just because Mueller is involved in it, you don't know until we really get the pieces and put them together. I mean, I don't know that, but I'm just saying the transactions between the Democrat Party, Fusion GPS, and everybody else going in, all these records and everything else, I think they'll find out when they get the bank records where all the money – because in any crime, my assumption is follow the money, and you're probably going to find the crime if there is a crime. So my assumption is if they get bank records from Fusion GPS, in politics, the trail goes crazy, right? It goes every which way, and people do all sorts of things like that. But I think I think once you follow the money and where payments flow to some people, I think that's where you'll find the crime. If there was a crime involving the uranium, and I'm sure it's mixed up with Fusion GPS and the politics of the dossier against Trump and all that other stuff too. So again, I can only follow the story from the news. I'm not following it from like a super detailed point of what the FBI has.
Yeah, and when it comes down to the actual deal, the uranium trading deal, about 20%, and that's a misleading statistic, of the uranium reserves of the United States, and by that we don't mean already refined or any of that, about 20% of the known uranium still in the ground was sold to a Russian country or a Russian company. What isn't talked about here is that that area is not producing uranium at all. It is really low-grade uranium, and the refining process for that would be about 50 times as expensive as the places that we are actually mining uranium. The reason is because it's locked so deep in granite. And it's way deep. You've got to get to it. Now, we can detect it because it's slightly radioactive.
Right.
The other end of that is that it's impossible to export uranium from the United States.
without a congressional sign-off. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to do an export license. That's got to be approved, and the Congress is involved in that process. So there's this huge amount of hoopla being made over. There's not even mines there. It's too expensive
But I think with the crime, we don't know until, we can only speculate to what the crime would be. But my assumption is the crime that's being paid is that the kickbacks for all the stuff. If Clinton got paid for giving speeches, for access to his wife's State Department, stuff like that, for access to uranium or something like that.
Okay.
That's where the crime is.
Right, exactly.
Let me address it. You can go to Snopes and find this, by the way. I know what you're talking about now.
The Trump campaign claimed about this time last year that Hillary Clinton sold off 20% of the uranium in the United States to a Russian company in exchange for a kickback to the foundation, to the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
If you look at it, you'll find out the
State Department didn't have anything to do with that trade.
If you go look back at that event, a couple of points. The contribution of the Clinton Foundation came from a guy who sold all of his interest in the company in question back in 2007. So he had the guy who made the contribution to the Clinton Foundation had nothing to do with the company at this point. Secondly, Hillary Clinton had nothing to do with, as Jake said, nothing to do with the decision allowing the company purchase. It just is a series of normal corporate purchases that somebody dug up and is making a big deal out of. There is nothing there. I mean, I've looked at this and it's been investigated from 14 directions. Now I know what you're talking about. I thought you were talking about the Mueller incident.
Right. Well, Mueller incident, he did do some research into this, but it's basically not.
I don't know about the Mueller incident, what he had. I mean, look, the FBI, you don't know. You could try to conspiracy theory it all together. FBI, I'm sure, is involved in it.
The FBI has been completely open with it at this point. They said that Robert Mueller was involved in the transfer of this small sample, but it was with intent of setting up a sting, and the people and the Russians were cooperating. They recovered the sample, sent it back to the United States, and caught the criminals who were supposed to be caught in the sting, and they went to prison.
This is the final kind of nail in the coffin from the national security perspective. It's not the nail in the coffin for the end of if there were political bribes being done. We need to find that. But the nail in the coffin is most of the uranium that we in the United States are using right now isn't even coming from the United States. It's coming from Africa. Niger, Namibia, and South Africa produce 18% of the world's uranium, and it's at high quality. And so the danger is that Niger and Namibia are not in good places right now. I mean, the place is their country. Their country's in turmoil, and the Chinese and the Russians and the French and a lot of other people are involved in trying to create some stability there, and that's part of the reason why, is that the best uranium around is there or in Siberia. There's some in Alaska that we're not even considering as part of the reserves. When we talk about the 20%, there's a large amount of uranium in Alaska that we're not even considering it as uranium. It's there. We just don't count it. So,
with the whole uranium, until we get more feedback, whatever happens to it, my understanding is that all this uranium deal and the dossier is it's intertwined somewhat, but just because of kickback and stuff like that. But there is somebody saying that there was the Podesta group who was the general that Trump fired early on in his campaign. He was the NSA guy. I forgot the guy's name.
Flynn.
He was Flynn. He was working for the Podesta group at the time. And there's a guy, and again, this is all speculation. You know, who knows if somebody's just not trying to politically kill somebody or something like that. You don't know. but he was saying that Flynn and Podesta worked together and were part of it and working with the Clinton Foundation, and that there were Russian,
I'm going to make a suggestion. It's not much fun. Never attribute to conspiracy what can be explained by simple stupidity.
Yeah, that's I found.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. When it comes to politics, I've always thought politics, you know, people do all sorts of things for money, kickbacks, robberies, and political power and everything else. And my whole deal with it is that Bill Clinton getting paid that amount of money from a speech in Russia while his wife is Secretary of State should be in every form of fashion illegal. Is it illegal? I don't know. They'll probably be fined out. But that whole situation, why I have a problem with people when I have a problem with the politics. People get paid for certain things, where it's kind of, it's not really. It's, you know, they just like me and they want to hear me. No, it's not.
Yeah.
People give politicians money for influence.
We
got to play some commercials for money, and we're not even politicians.
See ya. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we're going to break for some commercials and be back on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And 773-1400, local area code, of course, 254. 773-1400 is the telephone number. You can reach us by email at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And we do monitor our email while we're sitting in here jabbering at these foam balls. But you can give us a call and ask questions, make comments. Try to keep it to something to do with the economy or
right. We're about 5 minutes left this hour. We've got a whole hour ahead of us, though.
There's just a lot of the issues. The issues are not big, but they are significant. For example, instead of the big numbers like the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 29% so far in the last 12 months, that's really big and impressive and is likely to go away. The big number that I saw this week was in orders for durable goods.
Mm-hmm.
That's stuff that you buy with the expectation of keeping it and using it for a number of years. That's everything from washing machines to jet aircraft. It was up
air conditions, heating.
Right. It was up 2.2% in a month. 2.2% of that. Now that is about a 25% annualized rate.
That's fits nicely with the hurricanes, though.
Well, it does, except that it appears that the things that people are buying across the country, I mean, how many people across the country had to buy a new washing machine because of a hurricane?
If they were in Houston, they bought a lot. And well,
they have, and that was that. There's some commentary on that, but the point is that the sales. It's kind of like the new home sales should have declined because of the hurricane.
Right, but it
except
didn't.
They went up, and the durable goods purchases include jet aircraft and big items scattered across
the economy. Have a lot to do with the hurricane at all.
It doesn't. I think it's still a little early to see hurricane because people basically are still cleaning their houses out. They haven't really gone in and bought a new washing machine yet. I think we're going to see. I think the net result of the hurricanes will be that there's a lot of, and I said this in the newsletter, and we've said it on the radio. I think it's a net positive because the insurance companies are buying a lot of stuff. The federal government is stepping in and spending a lot of money. And apparently the recovery process will generate some economic activity across the board. The crucial issue, and it was an investigation, by the way, I don't know if you know this, in Texas, on why it's taking so long to clean up the mess. There's garbage piled in front of people's houses, and it may be 3 weeks before anybody comes and picks it up. There's not enough people to pick up the garbage.
We need more garbage collectors.
We need more people willing to work at the low end of the economic spectrum and pick up garbage is piled up in front of people's houses. We just don't have enough.
Or very soon we'll just have drones do it. We'll have machines get out of the truck and pick up the stuff and dump it in the truck.
Little Amazon drones coming along and picking up a piece
and
of paper.
We're not that far from it. And I don't live in Austin anymore. I live in Salado now. But the Austin trash trucks, as opposed to the trash trucks in the Temple, Killeen, Belton, Salado area, Austin trash trucks have one person working. He's the driver, yeah. Or she's the driver, and a machine on the side of the truck reaches out and grabs the can and lifts it up and dumps it in the back. Now, we've got two or three people that work on trash, and they get off and they pull the trash around and stick it onto the machine, which then picks it up. And
well, that's one of the problems. They had that in Houston, and they don't have enough people to come pick up piles of garbage.
Right. It's not a trash can. It's not a thing specifically designed to be grabbed by the truck, but that eventually is going to get fixed too. And that, if you've ever looked at video of an Amazon warehouse, you will see that robots are getting pretty good at stuff.
They're getting pretty good at stuff, but I think figuring out what to pick up when you've got a bunch of stuff piled in front of your house, what is the car? You don't pick the car up and put it in the garbage truck.
Well, that might be nice. Some cars really need to be picked up.
Yeah, but
you
in this case, I think there's some things like this that are out of the ordinary where you just need a lot of people who are willing to work and do physical labor. And that is one of the problems we're running into in the economy.
Well, we're about out of time this hour. If you would like to call us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Voicemail's waiting. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to podcasts, read our newsletter, see our made-for-radio faces. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
The voice of Central Texas, KTEM AM 1400, Temple, Belton, Killeen.